Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like everyone to please take your seats. I'd like to call the Health and Human Services Finance Division to order. We have a lot on our agenda today, so we'd like to get started. And we do have a quorum present, and is there a motion to approve the minutes of March 20th, 2019? Representative Bierman moves approval of the minutes of March 20th, 2019. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Hearing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you. The minutes are approved. So we are today going to be hearing House File 2184, and that is the governor's budget bill for House and Human Services. And I am the author of the bill, but since I'm not really the, even though I'm the author, I don't have any personal testimony of my own on the bill. I'm going to be, we're going to be hearing from the commissioners, and we're going to be taking public testimony. Therefore, I'm going to stay chairing the committee, which is a little bit unusual. Usually when the chair is the author of a bill, the chair goes to the table to present it. But this is a little bit different, so I hope that's okay with everybody. I'm just going to stay right here, and we're going to hear the bill with the agencies presenting. And then we're going to hear extensively from the public. So just to give everyone a little bit of a roadmap, we're going to start with some brief presentations on the bill. And then what we're going to, and the members, by the way, have the bill before you in a folder. It's a little bit unusual. You usually see just a pile of paper in your packet. But this book, which Ms. Niedernhofer and the pages have kindly put together for you, is the bill. So you've got it here for reference should you want to refer to it as the testimony is going. I just do want to remind people of what the process is here. So this is the governor's budget. It is not the committee's omnibus bill. So at the end of the hearing, and the hearing will, we expect the hearing will actually go into the evening. We're going to try to get the public testimony in during our regular committee time. That's why we're limiting everyone to 1 minute on each topic. But at the end of our hearing today, the bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And that means this is not the last time that the public will have a chance to discuss the provisions. It is not the last time that members will have an opportunity to offer an amendment. So I just want to make that very clear. Even though this bill is certainly about the size of what an omnibus bill might look like, this is not our omnibus bill. It's the governor's recommendations for what he would like to go in our omnibus bill. So just so members are clear and the public is clear on that. So after we have the presentations, we'll start with public testimony. Our agenda lays out the sections. We're going to do the testimony by topics. So on our agenda, we have topics in the order in which we will take them. We will take testimony from people that have given us their names as wanting to testify. 1 minute per person per topic, please. And I realize it's very difficult to do, but in order to allow everyone to be heard, we need to really keep it to 1 minute, and we will be timing you, and we will ask you to stop when the minute is done. We'll ask you to complete the sentence you're on and then stop. At the end of each topic, we will allow members of the public to testify who are not on the list, but again, everyone will be limited to 1 minute on the topic that we're addressing at that point. So with that, I think Commissioner Malcolm is going to begin. Please come down, Commissioner. Welcome back to the committee. We've had the pleasure of seeing you quite a bit this week, and would like you to go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, and please begin.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Jan Malcolm, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Health. You have been extremely generous with your time, and we've really enjoyed the conversation over the last couple of days on issues that are so important to all of our state. Appreciate the opportunity to talk to you very briefly again today about the governor's budget recommendations for MDH. The last few days, we've been talking about health insurance, how we pay for it, about what's driving up health care costs and what can be done to moderate them, how to get more value out of the spending we all make collectively in terms of the ultimate outcome of our health system, which ought to be the health of our people. Since the beginning of session, we've been talking about a wide range of topics: opioids, suicide, elder care, tobacco cessation, infectious disease, the capacity of our public health laboratory, managed care regulation, cannabis, drinking water, and health disparities. These are all critical issues. This list is broad, and the details can become blurred together and mind-numbingly complex when we're into the weeds on any of these very critical issues. But if you step back, you can actually see, I hope, that these health challenges have something in common, perhaps more than you might suspect. I believe we can perhaps advance the conversation by recognizing that there's a single major theme running through all of these issues, and that is our need to invest more in prevention. Prevention saves money. Prevention saves time. And most importantly of all, it saves lives. Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan understand the power of prevention, and you can truly see that theme running throughout their One Minnesota budget in all of the budget areas. In health and health care, this shows up in their recommendations by investing in programs that lower our rates of obesity and tobacco use, by investing in innovative approaches to reduce opioid dependence, by investing resources to strengthen drinking water protection. We can save communities across the state from having to find their own resources to do this critical function, by investing in modernized regulatory systems overseeing care facilities serving vulnerable adults. We can avoid the suffering and loss that come with abuse and neglect. In one way or another, that theme of prevention runs through every one of the items that we have described in previous hearings in the MDH budget. I just want to touch on a couple of those again. As you know, part of the governor's budget proposal centers on protection of vulnerable adults in care facilities in Minnesota. All Minnesotans have the right to live in dignity and free from harm, but in recent years, we collectively, and by we, I do mean we regulators, we policymakers, we members of the community, have collectively not always met that responsibility to protect seniors and vulnerable adults from maltreatment. By working with a broad group of stakeholders over the past few months, we've built really important agreements, I believe, on the need for not trivial changes, but structural changes in how we protect older and vulnerable adults. The governor's budget plan incorporates what we've learned from those community conversations and provides a vision for moving forward. The budget plan invests in required improvements to our regulatory capacity, but also modernizes our laws to deal with the increased popularity and complexity of assisted living settings in which 41,000 Minnesotans now reside. It holds providers accountable and gives residents and families more power and more information to make good choices. By adopting a new system of licensing assisted living facilities, Minnesota will join the vast majority of states in providing greater regulatory oversight for this large, important, and growing industry that serves so many of our citizens. This investment in improving our regulatory system will help prevent maltreatment, leading to a stronger system of care for our loved ones and build confidence that our loved ones are getting the quality of care and the respect that they deserve. Another major component of the governor's budget proposal for MDH is in drinking water. Keeping our drinking water safe is an absolutely fundamental task for state and local government. Failure to do this right has huge health and financial consequences, as a number of communities around the nation have been learning so painfully. Here in Minnesota, we have a unique and proactive approach. MDH is able to provide customized technical support and partnership for local drinking water systems, 7,000 public drinking water systems around the state, giving these systems tools they otherwise would likely not have to protect water and prevent contamination. To ensure that we can continue this innovative Minnesota approach, the governor's proposal includes an adjustment of the safe drinking water fee. The fee would increase by a modest penny per day per service connection, up to $9.72 per connection per year. I just want to reinforce that's per year, not per week, not per month, but per year. This prudent investment will allow the state to remain proactive in our work to protect drinking water, will importantly allow us to avoid shifting costs and technical burden to public water suppliers, many of whom are small business owners. A critical public health emergency that we've talked a lot about, and I appreciate the legislature's concern for this, is the opioid crisis in our state. In 2017, 422 more Minnesotans died from an opioid overdose. These numbers have been going steadily, inexorably up here and across the nation. Each one of those deaths carries a personal, family, and community cost. The governor's budget includes investments that can help turn the tide of this epidemic through provisions that ensure expanded access to life-saving naloxone, timely access to treatment for substance abuse disorder, and evidence-based prevention approaches in healthcare settings and in communities. Suicide rates are also going up in Minnesota, essentially at the same unacceptable, frightening, rapid pace of increase as deaths from alcohol, opioids, and other drugs, including methamphetamine. Every death from suicide is a family and a community loss that we mourn and that we wish we could have prevented. The governor's budget calls for an investment to support a comprehensive, community-based suicide prevention program, building upon a public-private partnership to expand, strengthen, sustain, and support community-based suicide prevention strategies across Minnesota, including rebuilding an important state-based crisis response call system. The committee has heard separately about the importance of retaining quitline services to help us continue to deal with the number one cause of preventable disease in Minnesota, tobacco use. So I won't dwell upon that, but appreciate the time that you've given to that issue. We spent last night talking about the Healthcare Access Fund and how important that is to assure that we can continue to build on a foundational set of prevention strategies that now are reaching every part of our state with I think, extremely promising results. And the importance, and you've heard me say since the beginning of our time with the committee earlier this session, that I just so firmly believe that a balanced approach to prevention and dealing with the problems that exist right before us is what we need to bend the cost curve over the long term. I firmly believe that the reason we're where we are today is because we have not, as a society, taken seriously enough the ability and the imperative to work on the prevention side. That what we've watched happen over the last decades as health behaviors led to a rising burden of chronic disease, we haven't done enough to understand how to support healthier behaviors in the context of communities and policies that support and make easier, healthier choices for our people. And that's really, I think, such a key strategy for bending that cost curve in the long haul. Madam Chair and members, I know that you have heard in prior budget presentations, we've gone sort of line by line through each of our budget proposals. I would be delighted to answer your questions on any of it, but in view of your very precious time here today, I wanted to just hit a couple of the highlight themes. And with that, Madam Chair, I will be happy to stand for questions.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. We are going to hold questions. So the way we're structuring the day, just so everyone understands, is we're going to have the presentations, we're going to take public testimony, and then we're going to take member questions and any amendments in probably in our evening session, because I think most of our time will be taken up. And frankly, I think we find it really valuable to hear from the public, and it may help frame some of our questions as well and help us understand the bill, you know, better.
Excellent.
So thank you very much, Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And, of course, I neglected to move the bill, which is kind of important. So I am the author of it, so I will move that House File 2184 be laid over for possible inclusion in our division omnibus bill. So with that, I'd like to call up Commissioner Lori to discuss the DHS portion of the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. 3 days in a row. This is I'm getting more comfortable up here, and glad to be here to present the portions of the governor's budget in this capacity. Now, I understand we're trying to hit the highlights. It's pretty tough to go through line by line in a brief segment. So I'm going to respect that process and try to just cover this in sort of buckets of how we approach setting the governor's budget. The Governor Walz budget for 20 and 21 really strengthens human services by making investments that support the Department of Human Services' mission to help people live in dignity and achieve their highest potential. And addressing the deep disparities in access and outcomes in Minnesota is a key theme that you will see across the entirety of the budget as we begin to discuss it. As members may recall, the proposals in this bill represent an all-funds impact of $274 million in the 20 and 21 biennium, which is an increase of 0.68% over our base budget for Health and Human Services. So then to address the buckets, and I'll to say when I'm hitting each bucket, the first one is children and families. In this area, the bill invests $58.6 million of additional investments, $42 million of which is in the child care and program integrity portion. The new investments in this portion of the bill would help children and families in Minnesota thrive by several initiatives. First, increasing the cash grant for MFIT by $100 per month. This would be the first cash grant assistance increase since 1986. It is long overdue. It has fallen far, far, far behind inflation during that 35-plus years. Secondly, buying down the basic sliding fee wait list for 1,000 families, improving quality and addressing continuing concerns around fraud is also a really critical piece of this part of the budget. In addition to increasing base rates based on the most recent survey in our child care assistance program. This children and families part of the proposals would also improve the child protection system by expanding the American Indian Child Welfare Initiative tribe status to an additional two tribes, as well as creating a child welfare training academy and working toward meeting the requirements of the federal Families First Prevention and Services Act in order to enhance and support children and families and really try to move some of those investments upstream and keep families together. The bill, the second larger bucket is the $35 million in behavioral health care to improve access to treatment and care for Minnesotans struggling with serious mental illness or substance use disorder. It expands services to children through investments in school-linked mental health program, as well as children's intensive residential mental health treatment. Both those programs that are no longer funded by the federal side, we're going to make up that with state funds, and also expand our psychiatric residential treatment facility, currently capped at 150 beds over the course of the budget horizon. We're going to increase that by another 150 beds, as well as continue to expand the successful model of CCBHCs, Certified Community Behavioral Health Clinics in Minnesota, which provide coordinated care for substance use disorder and mental illness, as well as physical health. The budget also takes important steps in the behavioral health arena, trying to address the opioid epidemic with the new opioid stewardship fee. This bill invests in state grants to tribal nations and the five urban Indian tribal communities to improve access, coordination, and referrals for culturally specific opioid services, and adds a opioid stewardship fee advisory council to help us distribute funds across the state to really be targeted at both some of the child protection effects from the opioid crisis, as well as treatment and recovery efforts and prevention as well, as Commissioner Malcolm mentioned. The next bucket, it strengthens services for vulnerable adults and people with disabilities through several changes and investments, including $7.9 million for vulnerable adults and $45 million for long-term care services. The Governor Walz budget works to ensure safe environments for vulnerable adults and encourages people to report suspected maltreatment. This includes adding staff to the Office of the Ombudsman for Long-Term Care, as well as making investments in the MARC system, the Minnesota Adult Abuse Reporting Center, and additional information for consumers would also be available through an assisted living report card built off the same model that we have for the nursing facility report card. There's also in this package a proposal to reimagine how services are provided under the currently complex four separate waiver programs that would streamline services, and another would address workforce challenges as well. Nursing homes also would have greater incentives to increase quality and or maintain and improve their quality. The bill also, the next bucket, it preserves and enhances services for people in our direct care and treatment system with an $11.2 million additional investment in the 2021 biennium. This includes funding to continue residential and vocational services to more than 1,000 people with disabilities in our MSOCS facilities. Another proposal increases treatment capacity and simplifies the funding for our four state-run ERTS systems, the intensive residential treatment facilities, bringing them up to their full 16-bed license capacity. Additionally, the budget has measures to keep communities safe by funding the community preparation services and monitoring of sex offenders who are provisionally discharged by the courts. The next budget bucket is improving operations of state government so that we can better serve Minnesotans by investing $20 million in modernizing our technology systems and $936,000 in additional program integrity efforts. The updates to the technology systems to transform the human services delivery system would be those aimed at making a system that is more integrated and more person-centered, trying to keep run it for the benefit of people, not necessarily for the systems. The budget improves oversight of non-emergency medical transportation and other provider enrollment in state healthcare programs, as well as bolstering county fraud prevention efforts through additional grants. The final package is the comprehensive health offered through the One Care Minnesota, which we jumped into a couple of days ago. So I'll cover this briefly. One Care is a package of proposals that addresses rising health care costs and improves access to care. It includes a statewide option to buy into comprehensive health care coverage that has the broad benefit set and broader networks similar to that in the Minnesota Care Program, as well as additional buy-in options in any region of the state where the individual market fails to provide coverage choices for individuals living in those regions. And the One Care package also leverages the state's purchasing power to bring down prescription drug costs and create a simpler and more equitable model to help dentists serve all patients in their own communities and address disparities in dental care across the entire state. So that's the very brief run through.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Laurie. We appreciate the overview and look forward to talking with you some more, and it's been wonderful to have the 3 days, and we know it won't be the last time you'll be here.
I've enjoyed it myself very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Okay, so we're going to turn now to public testimony. I would like to say to members of the public, if you have letters or other documents that you want to distribute to the committee, please give them to the page ahead of time if possible. And in order to facilitate everyone getting a chance to speak who wishes to, we're going to ask people to kind of get ready. I'm going to read off who we've got on the list and ask you to kind of come down and be ready do your testimony. So first on the list, first we're going to deal with the mental health issues in the bill, and we're going to start with Sue Abderholden. Next is Ginny Palin. Then Rod Peterson, Linnea Mersch, Jennifer Gozzi, and Stephanie Comby. And then after that, if there are other testifiers, we will take you as well, people who want to testify on mental health. So Ms. Abderholden, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. In the Health Department, we appreciate the investment, which we've not seen in years, for suicide prevention, especially the network adequacy. We want to make sure that with health plans that the providers actually are alive and are taking new patients. We think that's helpful. And the Tobacco Cessation Quit Line. People with mental illness have the highest smoking rates. in the human services budget, you know, our mental health system isn't broken. It's never been built. And the things that are in there that we think will be helpful are increasing the funding for schooling to mental health, addressing the loss of federal Medicaid dollars for kids residential, including adding new PRTF beds, funding for certified community behavioral health clinics, funding for traditional healing practices for American Indians, increased funding for the transitions to community to move people out of state operated and off the waiting list from community hospitals, increasing the elderly waiver so we can have people who are over 65 actually move out of Anoka, making sure that people who are leaving residential treatment are automatically eligible for housing supports so they aren't discharged to the streets.
Okay. Please finish. Sorry, okay. It is really short.
Boy, and I thought I was really going there.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Abreholden. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Jenny Palin with the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs. We would like to say thank you to Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan for emphasizing mental health in this budget. In particular, a huge thank you for including certified community behavioral health clinics in the budget. Also, SchoolLink Mental Health, the room and board funding for mental health programs under the CDCTF, adult and children's mental health grants, and the community-based prevention pilot program. To Article 7 for the Uniform Services Standards Act, we would like to thank the department and the governor for the changes they've made to the diagnostic assessment requirements. There are several components that we're working on with DHS actively now on that, but they've been working well with us to hear our concerns and helping us find common ground. To our second response, we are disappointed that the proposal does not include a proposal to address the unsustainable reimbursement rates to the foundation of our mental health system as it currently stands. We agree with the long-term goals of the administration. We also know that those long-term goals will take several years to implement, and so we believe that there needs to be an approach that both helps us sustain provider services today as well as gets us to that long-term goal. But we look forward to working with the department and you all in moving this forward to build our mental health system. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Rod Peterson.
Chair Lewin and members of the committee, I'm Rod Peterson. I'm a county commissioner for Dodge County and chair of the AMC's Health and Human Services Policy Committee. I'm also chair for the Mid Prairie County Alliance and sit on the South Country Health Alliance Board and also our county-owned nursing home. Children's residential facilities. Counties recognize the tremendous need for services when it comes to mental health services for our children. Counties are responsible to help meet the needs of our children who have complex mental health conditions. As we know, there's great need. Currently, we have kids on waiting lists or being sent to facilities out of state at enormous cost to counties. The recent end to federal reimbursement for services at the state's children residential treatment centers that are over 16 beds has created serious concerns. Counties would not be able to afford to cover 100% of cost for care for these intensive services. We appreciate the continuation of funding. We also appreciate the proposal to help build capacity within the system to include psychiatric residential treatment facilities. These are a needed component to a full continuum of mental health care needed in our communities.
All right.
So that children have needed services.
Thank you so much. I'm so sorry about the one-minute time. It really is awkward, but I really appreciate everyone's efforts because we obviously have a lot of important folks to hear from. Please go ahead. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Linnea Mersch. I'm the Director of Health and Human Services for St. Louis County, and I'm here today on behalf of St. Louis County on MICA and MAXA. And so also just to echo Commissioner Peterson's comments about the intensive children's mental health services included here, I know that later today this body will consider gap funding for the remainder of this biennium for these children's intensive services. As the state funding, as you know, stops short. However, the governor's budget does not include this gap funding, but it does provide the sustaining and expanding access beyond this year through these services by extending that state funding to replace the lost federal funding through the coming years, and that is just critical for your county partners. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Did not use the whole minute. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for hearing me today. My name is Dr. Jennifer Gozzi. I'm a licensed psychologist and the Associate Director of Compliance and Quality Improvement at Washburn Center for Children, nonprofit mental health agency serving over 3,500 children a year. I'm here with you today to testify in support of the Uniform Standards and Mental Health section of this bill. This bill is crucial to the future of mental health regulation. One of our most time and resource-demanding challenges as an agency is the rigid and impractical paperwork expectations required for billing services. Current standards do not account for simple things like human error, technology failure, or larger things like cultural differences and barriers to treatment. The flexibility that this bill provides will certainly improve the continuity and quality of care for clients and the quality of life for providers. Additionally, updating and streamlining the rules and regulations is long overdue and will greatly improve efficiency for providers, which will lead to improved client care and access to services for more children and families. Thank you
very much. And Stephanie Combe, welcome.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Stephanie Combe. I'm the licensed independent clinical social worker and senior director of mental health services at St. David Center. I also currently serve as the board president of Aspire Minnesota. I'm grateful for the opportunity to speak in support of the uniform services standards in this bill. For 20 years, I've been a leader of mental health services for children in the nonprofit sector. I've also actively participated in CTSS committees with Aspire Minnesota. In these roles, I have experienced the focus of conversations among leaders shifting from the best treatment interventions to addressing ongoing challenges of compliance with the various requirements, often noted in various statutes and rules, at times conflicting, and most concerning, not focused on meeting the needs of those we serve. One example is the individual treatment plan. Currently, the standards require that an ITP is reviewed every 90 days and signed by the parents or guardians. While on the surface this seems very reasonable, in reality it has had some unintended consequences. To accomplish the requirement, it requires parents who are willing and able to engage consistently in a child's services and follow through.
I need you to wrap up, please.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on this section of the bill, the mental health section? Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair,
give us your name.
And members, thank you. I'm Dominic McQuarrie, Public Policy Manager at the Wilder Foundation. We want to testify in favor of the Certified Community Behavioral Health Clinic section of the bill. As a CCBHC, we've seen the benefits of the integration of behavioral health and substance use and outpatient mental health, and it's been a huge help for us. So we're excited to see that continue and then hopefully expand in the bill. Also, we'd like to see the uniform service standards that are in the bill. Our current system is too fractured for both staff and participants to navigate in a logical way, and we are hopeful that this will help push us in a direction where we have a more cohesive system that serves people in the ways that they need. Additionally, we're happy to see an expansion of school-linked mental health in this bill, and we're hopeful that throughout the process we could add the section that is in Representative Edelson's House File 814 related to specialized schools that are dealing with students with higher needs. So like a lot of things in the bill, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. And please be sure to see the page and make sure that they get your information before you go. And to everyone who testifies, we do need to capture your, if we haven't already, we need to get your name and your contact information. All right. Thank you. We will turn to the MFIP and housing section of our testimony. And we have on the list Jessica Webster, Senta Leff, Fatima Moore, Juliana Keene, Linnea Mersch, and Bharti Wahi. And then we will also allow other folks. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jessica Webster. I'm a staff attorney with Legal Aid, and we stand in support of the governor's inclusion of an increase to the MFIP cash grant, which we've had a lot of conversation about in this committee. I think it's $100 in the governor's budget. Advocates would like to see that go further. And I'll just note that the governor uses general fund to fund the increase to MFIP, and there's still a $50 to $54 million TANF reserve that could be used for that grant. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Webster. Next person, please. And yeah, if everyone could please come down. Yeah, if everyone could kind of get ready to go in order so that we can kind of keep things moving. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and committee members for the opportunity. My name is Senta Leff, and I'm here representing the Homes for All Coalition. The administration's proposal leaves out vital investments to services that support and stabilize families, adults, and children who are at risk of homelessness. Yesterday, you might have heard that Wilder Research released their triennial homeless study, and the results are really alarming. Homelessness in Minnesota has increased by 10% since 2015, and importantly, our unsheltered population has spiked dangerously in the same period. The total number of people not even in emergency shelter has increased by 62%, folks who are actually outside, and the rate of unsheltered children went up by 56%. So these numbers relay the stark reality that we already are aware of, and it's a statewide issue. I know last week you welcomed 850 advocates from across the state. So thank you for the inclusion of House File 1043.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Fatima Moore, and I'm the Public Policy Director at Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. MCH is pleased to see a $100 increase in the Minnesota Family Investment Program, which is included in Article 20 of the governor's budget. As you know, MFIP cash assistance has not increased since 1986. I was 5 years old at the time. The maximum level of assistance for a family of three is just $532 a month. This is definitely a program that many families access who are working low-wage jobs. It's essentially a de facto unemployment insurance for many families, and we are hopeful that this will be the year where we do see an increase in the MFIP cash assistance grant. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Juliana Keene and then Linnea Mersch. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Juliana Keene. I'm speaking on behalf of Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota. LSS has been providing services to people with disabilities, older adults, children, youth, and families for over 150 years. Our 2,300 employees and 8,000 volunteers provide services in every Minnesota county. And I would also like to speak in support of the increased investment in MFIP. This would significantly impact LSS's employment services participants, their children, and Minnesota's communities as a whole. We really appreciate the department and the governor's office for including this increase in the bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members, counties do applaud the governor's effort to make some immediate investments that will assist in getting families the resources they need. You know, just to point to note, St. Louis County, specifically our department, funded in two warming centers this winter due to the unsheltered numbers in St. Louis County, north and south. We appreciate the governor's proposed investments in children and families. This $100 per month increase in MFIP is only the beginning, but an important step in helping working families on their way towards self-sufficiency. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And you are Linnea Mersch, right? All right, thank you. All right, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on the... Oh, I'm sorry, who did I miss here? Oh, I'm sorry, Barty Wally. Wahi.
No problem. Hi, my name is Barty Wahi. I'm the Executive Director of the Children's Defense Fund. And thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for the chance to speak. I am here today to talk about our... to express our gratitude to the governor and the lieutenant governor on their increase in the MFIP cash grant. As other testifiers said, the cash grant has not increased in some time. I was a little bit older than Fatima, but not by much. And MFIP is a children's issue. 71% of the children accessing the MFIP program are children. Right. So and more than half of the MFIP households have children under the age of six, and have 10% have infants. So this is an issue that really supports children's economic stability and viability moving forward. You know, we appreciate an increase that is larger than $100, but we are grateful that the governor has included this in his budget. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. And then welcome to the committee. Just please give us your name and who you're affiliated with, and go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ann Kuznick with the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition representing people of faith across the state of Minnesota. You've heard about the importance of the MFIP grant. I want to make sure that it's clear that it's working. The average stay on MFIP is about 10 months, so families are successfully using MFIP as it's designed, as a safety net as they move into economic stability. You've also heard about the extensive number of children on MFIP. We know that 80% of brain development happens in the first 3 years of life, and we want to make sure those children have adequate nutrition and shelter and care during that time. I'll just close by saying we really appreciate the governor's increase in the Genship grant, because the current grant is really failing to meet our obligation to provide human dignity to these children and families. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And just a reminder to everyone, please be sure to sign in with the pages so that we and you're being followed by a page right now. Okay. We're going to turn now to direct care and treatment portion of the bill. And we're going to have Eric Hesse and Laura Sales, Rod Peterson, and then we'll open it up for anyone else. Welcome to the committee.
Hello, and thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Eric Hesse, and I work as a security counselor lead at the Minnesota Sex Offender Program in St. Peter. I'm also vice president of Ask Me Local 404. I'm here to support the PROS funding increase in the governor's budget for the sex offender program. For me, this is a workplace safety issue, as staffing levels are already dangerously low. At times, there are staff alone left alone on the unit with up to 30 clients for 2 to 3 hours. There are also staff that even work alone for the whole shift. The staffing shortage is partly due to the unfunded expansion of community preparation services and reintegration service programs. Expanding these programs was a matter of public safety because DHS in the state of Minnesota was on the verge of being court-ordered to release dangerous sex offenders back into your communities. This funding increase will largely be used to fund existing unfunded positions. If DHS does not get its funding, the dangerous staffing levels will be maintained, and I fear they may even get worse. I believe that is a matter of when, not if, something horrible is going to happen due to these inadequate staffing numbers. We shouldn't have to be injured for you to listen to us about our safety in our workplace. I encourage you all to take a proactive report approach and help fix this issue. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Hi, my name is Laura Sales, and I'm with the Minnesota Nurses Association. You should have a letter that has a lot more information about the things that we're following in the budget. But for now, we're here in support of the proposals to increase the funding for the Minnesota Sex Offender Treatment Program and the MSOCS operating adjustment. MNA nurses are part of the staff that help ensure the patients in these programs, who can be some of the state's most vulnerable patients or that the state is court-ordered to care for, receive quality care. Because the community preparation services and the reintegration services have not received any specific appropriations in past budgets, the program has needed to reduce the number of direct care physicians to stay within their budgets. So funding these two services will mean that current program resources can be used for direct care positions. And then we're also in support of the MSOCS operating adjustment. This would allow the program to provide ongoing funding for approved salary, insurance, and pension payments for the program. Thanks.
All right. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm Rod Peterson, we want to, for the AMC, we want to raise our concerns about the 25% cost share for the counties to help cover the cost of care for clients who are provisionally discharged from the Minnesota Sex Offenders Program. Counties support state budget solutions which avoid adding or shifting a burden to counties through cost shift, cost shares, and unfunded mandates. Because when a cost shift is applied, the workload does not go down for our county staff. Local property taxpayers just make up the difference. Counties have long cautioned an over-reliance on local property taxes to not be a stable or equitable way to fund human services for the long term. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the room who wanted to testify on direct care and treatment? Okay, not seeing anybody. So we will go on to the child care portion of the bill. And we have Ann Krisnick, Elizabeth Bangert, Jessica Webster, Bharti Wahi, Cindy Cunningham, and I think that's all we have on the list at this time. So, Ms. Krisnick, I think you're on. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, hello again. I'm Ann Krisnick with the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition, but I'm speaking on behalf of the broader Kids Can't Wait Coalition. We appreciate the governor's commitment to the CCAP program. Not only the changes in policy addressing families experiencing homelessness, those who move from county to county, allowing people to move off MFIP more quickly, but also recognizing the importance of moving the families off the waiting list. There are currently over 2,100 families on the MFIP waiting list, and the governor's budget would address 1,000 of those. It also would raise the market rate when we're looking at reimbursement to a current market rate instead of 2011. We know that access to child care is key for families moving into economic stability and, as well, key for employers to be able to fill positions. So thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
My name is Elizabeth Bangert. I'm the owner and director of Here We Grow Early Childhood Center in Mankato, and 60 seconds is not enough time to talk about any of these bills, so this is like some messed up version of speed dating for legislation. That's literally what this is. This is a joke to the public who have actual thoughts to share. I've listened to nothing but nonstop agencies for the last 2 months, and I think this whole entire process is asinine. I have over 7,000 pages of data about what's happening inside the Office of Inspector General, including the other individuals who oversee licensing and other things up there. So maybe we should address the actual maltreatment that's being hidden, the people who have four-star parent-aware ratings that have over 16 counts of maltreatment, the fact that there's massive rampant fraud, and that one agency oversees all of them. So enjoy your view from your balcony in your house of cards, because 52 card pickup's about to happen.
Thank you for your testimony, Jessica Webster.
Wow. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jessica Webster. I'm a staff attorney with Legal Aid, and we stand in support of the investments in child care in this bill for all the reasons that Ms. Krisnick said. These are important investments, and they're for children. Thank you.
Thank you. Bahi Wahi.
Hi. I'm here again to talk about children and the fact that child care assistance program is actually a two-generation approach. It supports parents and their ability to go to work. It also supports children and their development. We're grateful that the governor has put this in his budget, and hope the committee will consider both the family-friendly provisions that are tied to the federal conformity. We need to get into compliance with the federal block grant, so we support those elements. And then finally, as Mr. Krisnick said, there are 2,100 children still waiting to receive this program. We are very interested in ensuring all children who need this program can access it, and we support the governor's investment in reducing the number of children on the wait list. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. I'm sorry I mispronounced your name. Could you just say your name into the thing? Because I think I blew it, so please say your name.
No, you were super close. My name is Barti Wahi from the Children's Defense Fund.
Thank you. Okay, welcome to the committee.
Hi, Cindy Cunningham. I'm the public policy chair for McPinn. It's the 501c3 Association for Family Child Care Providers. I'm going to speak a little bit. There's policy in here as much as budget, so a few things to go on record for policy. The use of the terminology emergency substitutes within the bill is being changed by DHS, and I trust that amendment and other wording gets changed on that to help providers. Current substitutes and other care providers will need time to be able to be assimilated into the training program or training expectations. For substitutes is being changed from days to hours. That would allow me, instead of counting my 2 hours here today as a full day, it can be 2 hours. However, it would be advantageous to increase those hours to a 400 or 500 rather than 300. A couple bills that are not included that would be budgetary items that I've been looking through the rest of the session. An ombudsperson for providers to be able to talk to, a plain language handbook, a tier system model of monitoring. And regarding CCAP, yes. As a provider, that didn't be in the
slide. Wrap up. I'm sorry.
I'm asking for more than a couple years. I get 7 years off of the food program if I do a problem with that.
Thank you. And it was just a reminder to everyone in the room that we also will be happy to take your comments in writing. This is not the only opportunity, and especially for people that really have more extensive things to say, please do give it to us in writing as well, either today or later on. Okay, so we are finished with the child care portion. We have child welfare. And I'm sorry, I did not ask if there's anyone else in the room who wants to talk about child care. Welcome back.
Didn't want to miss my shot.
Yeah.
Again, I'm Dominic McQuarrie, with Public Policy Manager at the Wilder Foundation. We're very happy to see the investments in CCAP as a member of the Kids Can't Wait Coalition. And finally, a big investment and opportunity to address some of the wait list issues that we have in the state. Additionally, because I did miss my chance on this earlier, I want to thank the inclusion of the MFIP increase to the cash grant. It's been far too long, and we would like to see that go even further if possible. And also, we're hopeful that by the end of session we'll see an investment in some of the housing programs that are under the purview of this committee. As the Wilder Foundation, we do this three-year survey, which was released yesterday, and as Ms. Leff said, the numbers were alarming in what we're seeing across the state. So we still have time in the session to address this, and we're hopeful that the committee will do so. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wanted to speak about child care? Okay. We'll move to child welfare then. Oh, Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Madam Chair, I understand the time constraints fully. I've been in your position as well. This is the people's house, and we need to hear from the people. I'm wondering, will there be another opportunity for people to weigh in on this bill? I understand this is the governor's rex, as you made very, very clearly, but will there be another opportunity in this process?
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. Just to put another point on it, absolutely there will be more opportunities. First of all, some of these bills have been heard and will be heard either in this committee or in our child care subdivision. So there will be much more attention to a lot of these issues we've already heard about today. But not only that, when the committee comes out with our omnibus bill, we will again take testimony on what does end up in our bill. And there will be a full opportunity for members to amend the bill, so therefore people who are unhappy with various provisions can talk to members about offering an amendment as well. So there is, you know, the process we have here, as we all know, is not a perfect process, but we do try within the limits of our human capabilities to bring in as much input as we possibly can.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. So we're going to move on now to child welfare. And we've got Debbie Harris and Linnea Mersch. Please come down. Oh, I'm sorry. I think things got turned around a bit. So anyway, go ahead. We've got people who are testifying on child welfare, and that's Linnea Mersch.
Okay. Madam Chair, members, thank you. We applaud the governor's proposed investments in the Child Welfare Training Academy. In St. Louis County, we have 60% of our child welfare, child protection workers who are new to their position in 18 months. This is really big for counties. The committee has also heard information from the Casey Family Programs and others about Families First Prevention Service Act, or Families First. This is huge. Counties see these federal resources as an opportunity to make monumental changes in our child welfare, to ensure that we're supporting families before children enter out-of-home placement, and that we're really stabilizing families to promote child safety. The governor did propose some infrastructure costs for our state to prepare for the most efficient, effective use of these federal dollars and this federal flexibility, and we appreciate this proposal because we think it's key for counties and other stakeholders to be at the table. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Was there anyone else who wanted to address sections in the bill that have to do with child welfare? Okay, not seeing anybody. So we will move on to the SEIU contract. Please come down and introduce yourself for the record.
Hi, thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Patsy Gibson. I am a home care worker for Bloomington. I am a member of the SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. I support the House File 2184 and specifically the section that ratifies and funds the contract for self-direct home care. I would like to thank the legislator of both parties who co-authored our standalone bill. I've been doing this job for 6 years. It's hard to care for someone else when you can't hardly afford to care for your own family. Right now, your paycheck is spent before you get it. If you get sick or need medicine, the copay and deductibles can eat your whole paycheck. I have to go to the food pantry to make sure I get enough to eat. We bargained a new contract with the state of self-directed workers. It moved the minimum wage from $12 to $13.25, fund pay and training, boost pays for time off, holidays, and more. It won't solve the crisis, but it's a great step toward. It's a great step forward for the 29,000 home care workers who are covered by the contract. The bill for $36 million to pay for this contract. This okay. also includes tens of thousands of
okay.
additional.
I'm sorry, I have to ask you to wrap
okay.
up.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank
Madam
you very
Chair
much for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to speak to the SEIU healthcare contract or the SEIU contract portion of the bill? Okay, I'm not seeing anybody. So we will go to the long-term care, vulnerable adults, and disability portion of the bill. And I think this is where we had Debbie Harris, then Sean Burke, Toby Pearson, Carrie Thurlow, Juliana Keene, Phil Griffin are the people on my list. So if you could kind of get ready to come down, that would be great. Welcome to the committee. Welcome. Please give us your name and go ahead.
Hi, Madam Chairman. And members, my name is Debbie Harris. I'm a board member of the ARC Minnesota. My son Josh is there sleeping in the corner. We are grateful to the Department of Human Services for their work on the provisions of importance to members of the disability community to improve access to services, choice, and budget control included in the House File 2184. 2184, for members of the disability community, 2184, I would like to highlight, however, some concerns with Article 5, Section 44 and 45 of the bill outlining the proposed reconfiguration of waivers for people with disabilities. I know how critical waivers are in keeping people at home in their communities, even in the most complicated situations. Through Josh's CAC waiver, in order to mitigate the nursing shortage, we use a mix of nursing and enhanced PCA services to provide the safety, comfort, and continuity of care that Josh needs to live a fulfilled life and to avoid unplanned hospitalizations. We acknowledge that the department intends to recalibrate the budgets and make changes to the assessments that determine those budgets, but seek reassurance that the meaningful opportunities for stakeholder input will be prioritized during these processes. And we look forward to working with the department to address those concerns at a more detailed level and greatly appreciate partnership for the future.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For your testimony. Okay, we have Sean Burke. Welcome. And if everybody else could kind of get ready, Toby Pearson, Carrie Thurlow, Juliana Keene, and Phil Griffin. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Sean Burke. I'm the Policy Director at the Minnesota Elder Justice Center. I'm talking specifically on Article 13, Adult Protection. We're well aware of the abuse and neglect issues in long-term care facilities and the reforms going on at the Office of Health Facility Complaints. But OHFC is only one of the lead investigative agencies that are empowered to investigate maltreatment. We rely on counties and tribes to investigate the majority of our state's maltreatment complaints that oftentimes happen in people's own homes and are perpetrated by caregivers and, unfortunately, loved ones. And unlike child protection, adult protection does not get dedicated federal funding. We rely on counties to fund a majority of this work, sometimes up to 70, 80, 90% of the APS services in a county. This sets us up for disparities both within counties and between counties. This bill goes a long ways to address that. Aside from adding more funding to APS units, state funding, these changes will allow tribes for the first time to access this funding. It'll tie the grant to specific measurable casework, and we will ensure that the funds do not supplant current existing county funds, so it will actually increase adult protection work. While we think the governor's proposal can be more aggressive in funding this, it's great to see much needed work for adult protection.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Toby Pearson with Care Providers in Minnesota and the Long-Term Care Imperative. Under Governor Wall's budget, nursing homes will lose more than $200 million in funding. $68 million cut from the state budget, a matching dollar from the federal money, and because of rate equalization, a matching private pay dollar. These cuts will have the greatest impact on employee wages and benefits and training. These proposed changes are in spite of the fact that the Department of Human Services' own report states that changes to value-based reimbursement system are premature because trends in the spending, access, and workforce are still developing. VBR has been a huge success in CNA wages going up more than 26%, LPN and RN wages going up more than 20%, full-time employees covered by employer-sponsored health insurance going up 10%. Despite this, we still continue to struggle with workforce issues. The proposed cuts come in several ways. First, the changes to the care-related limits and quality score. While we applaud the direction and the increase the incentives to quality, in our opinion, the blunt instrument approach taken by the governor's proposal is not acceptable.
Mr. Pearson,
second,
I need you to wrap up, please.
In short, in the midst of a $1 billion surplus, cuts to nursing homes and long-term care, especially their employees, do not make sense.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Carrie Thurlow with Leading Age Minnesota here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. My comments will focus on Article 14, which proposes significant changes to the way we regulate assisted living licensure. While we are pleased that the governor is prioritizing elder care protection and assisted living regulations and support the overall goal of increasing accountability and clarity for families and residents, the language in this bill right now does not reflect the emerging consensus of stakeholder work and at this time we cannot support this language. This is a work in progress, and I want to emphasize that we are meeting with stakeholder groups on a weekly basis, and as this proposal moves to the legislature, we encourage you to make sure that, remember that these are home and community-based services, not institutions, that we need to keep seniors at the center of this who are capable of choice and independence while also protecting safety. We need to protect access and affordability, and making sure that we are not having the opposite impact of potentially creating unsafe situations while also increasing fees massively as the language stands today.
Thank you, Ms. Thurlow. Okay, Juliana Keene and then Phil Griffin.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, I'm Juliana Keene from Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota. In the area of disability services, we greatly appreciate the inclusion of a competitive workforce factor for those accessing home and community-based services. As you're aware, we are experiencing a crisis in staffing like we have never seen before. The competitive workforce factor will begin to address the 17% wage disparity between direct support professionals and those of similar jobs in the same communities. While working to solve the current issues in our fee-for-service model, we also strongly support the language in line 182.14, which directs DHS to study and recommend value-based models and outcome-based payment strategies in HCBS. We know that people's lives are more complicated than fee-for-service allows, and exploring other models could better ensure people with disabilities have the best possible outcomes, and we think it could also lower per-person costs. Thank you.
Thank you. Perfect timing there. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Phil Griffin. I'm appearing today on behalf of CASIA, the new organization created by the merger of Elam Care and Bethesda. The governor's proposed budget makes changes to the property payment rate that will make it impossible for providers to rely on our partnership with the state to modernize our homes for our residents. The problem, simply stated, is that current law allows a provider to close a facility, saving the state significant Medicaid expenditures. The state calculates a saving to the budget and shares some of that savings with the provider. The provider can then use those savings to make improvements to another nursing home. The current law supports a long-standing goal of reducing the number of nursing home beds and improves the ones that remain. Closures have been made, money has been borrowed, and seniors are relying on the legislature to continue funding these constructions and all future projects. Please reject this proposed change of funding for our elderly. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'll yield my significant 5 seconds to another witness.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Griffin. Is there anyone else in the room who wanted to testify on long-term care, vulnerable adult provisions, and or disability provisions? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Sarah Grafstrom. I'm the Director of State and Federal Policy at ARM. First and foremost, I want to be here to express our support and gratitude for Governor Walz and his administration in including a competitive workforce factor in the disability waiver rate system. My prepared remarks very much mirror Ms. Keene's prepared remarks, so I will shorten them by saying the competitive workforce factor is a very important step in beginning to address the wage gap that direct support professionals are currently facing. I do, however, want to highlight our concerns with the governor's proposal to increase licensing fees for 245D providers. Preliminary analysis of the proposed fee schedule shows an average increase in licensing fees among our members of 61%, with fee increases for individual providers ranging from 20% to 300%. Our members are dedicated to providing the highest quality of services to individuals with disabilities. We understand and support the need to have appropriate licensing visits. However, a fee increase this drastic is problematic to providers. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Joe Cuoco. I am with the Vice President of Supportive Living Solutions. I'm here speaking on the issue of the Waiver Reimagined Project. We are asking to postpone a decision on the Waiver Reimagined Project with all the changes it creates, such as discontinuing independent living skills services, which about 25% of people on waiver receive, the removal of the ILS specialist, the creation of the two waiver buckets, which are a residential support waiver and individual support waiver that inadvertently creates loss of crucial services. We feel there needs to be more discussion with stakeholders to ensure continued services to the people of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wanted to testify in this area of the bill? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Susie Emmert, but I'm actually here on behalf of Melissa Haley. She's a parent advocate who asked me to testify for her because she could not find PCA support for her child this afternoon. And as a parent advocate and board member of the Minnesota Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities, or MNCCD, a broad-based coalition of advocacy organizations and service providers, we work to change public policy to improve the lives of people with disabilities. In a few areas that we wanted to note, Section 33, Article 5 establishes the competitive workforce factor that you've heard quite a lot about in this committee, and so we're pleased to see that. We'd also like to note that we have a strong hope that the process around the waiver reimagine work will include continued and robust engagement of the disability community statewide. And then we're also pleased to see that in Section 2, Article 20, that the healthcare access fund is considered to continue, and we really want to see that continue as well. So we want to say that we are grateful to the Department of Human Services for their openness to stakeholder feedback and their ongoing responsiveness to our questions through this process, and we look forward to working together.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wants to talk about those sections of the bill, long-term care, vulnerable adults, disability sections? Okay, and I know these folks are not coming down for that. So, okay, so we will move to the durable medical equipment section, and I have on the list, unless there's been a change. Okay, okay, very good. Mr. Newman, welcome to the committee.
Yes, Madam Chair, representatives. I'm here to discuss the $8 million proposed in cuts to durable medical and equipment based on unsustainable pricing derived from a national competitive bidding program, which has imploded. It's currently suspended based on widespread unaccessibility to our equipment supplies in rural America. The other part of that cost savings comes from a cost plus 20 that the department insists on pushing. You have rejected twice. The Senate has rejected twice. And there's a Judge Castro in Ramsey County currently has a temporary restraining order until you guys weigh in on a cost plus 20 program. No company in the United States in this service-based industry can survive on a cost plus 20 basis. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. I had, and Mr. Newman, I don't think you said your name into the record. Could you just tell us your name?
My name's Al Newman, currently representing MAME's 8-state organization of medical equipment and supply.
Thank you very much. I had Sarah Anderson, but please go ahead.
Yeah. Sarah Anderson is a board member of MAME. She was not able to make it today because her company, Home Care Delivered, is closing down all their medical equipment and supply operations in Minnesota. So it's been a very rapid closing. And some of you know Sarah from testifying over the years. Her family business, Key Medical, had to shutter its doors in the summer of 2017 when the preferred incontinence program was passed into law. Their creditors saw that, and they closed them within 36 hours. When that happens, those patients and their caregivers and their families are in an absolute scramble to find the right providers. Not all providers have the same products available, so it really creates quite a bit of chaos. We did have a conversation with the department before this hearing, and House File 1580, Edelson and Zuros are carrying maybe the alternative to this across-the-board cut.
I'm going to have to ask you to wrap it up, but you didn't say your name on the record, so I'll give you those few seconds. Please tell us who you are.
Bill Amberg, representing Maine.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. And Mr. Amberg, and we got some documents, and I assume that these are from you. Am I right? Okay. And so members have some documents in front of you regarding that issue. So is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on the durable medical equipment portion of the bill? And I'm not seeing anyone on that. Okay. We move then to the healthcare sections of the bill. So the lineup that I have right now is Jessica Webster, Mary Krinke, Laura Sales, Rod Peterson, Alita Borud, and then we'll ask for any other testifiers who are interested in coming down. So welcome to the committee, Ms. Webster.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jessica Webster. I'm a staff attorney with Legal Aid. And we just wanted to speak in support of the direction of an inclusion of OneCare. And we're particularly grateful in this budget for the provision that addresses dental access. Legal Aid has been long working on dental access across the state. And we think that's a really important provision. So thank you for hearing this testimony today. And we appreciate many of the inclusions in the governor's budget.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Ms. Krinke.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. Three quick items that I would like to mention. The first one, there's a small provision on page 367 that is important to hospitals. It brings Minnesota into compliance with a new federal rule regarding how the feds will pay for outpatient drugs for Medicaid patients. There's a small increase for the DSH hospitals that's disproportionate share hospitals. These are the hospitals that have the highest Medicaid volume in the state. It's to help offset just some of the losses that will be experienced with the new federal outpatient drug rule due to increased acquisition costs of very expensive drugs. In particular, these are cancer drugs for children's hospitals, HIV drugs, and blood clotting drugs for hemophiliacs for our safety net programs. Chair Liebling has a bill on this, a separate bill, House File 1297, that we are supporting. The second item that I would like to mention is on page 419. This is regarding increased license fees for hospitals, as well as a $125 fee for every prescriber of any medication. This is to support the opioid program. I heard that the rationale for this was that providers needed to have skin in the game. I would like to point out that hospitals have plenty of skin in the game. Last year, there were 1,400 babies born in Minnesota hospitals that were opioid addicted, and our ER volumes have gone to 36,000 per year. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. And okay, thank you for that testimony. Ms. Sales, please go ahead. Please say your name.
Hi again. My name is Laura Sales. I'm with the Minnesota Nurses Association. We've testified to other committees that we're pleased to see the OneCare proposal, as it's also carried in House File 3 as amended. We'll leverage the state's purchasing power for prescription drugs. Additionally, the dental plan included in OneCare will create equitable rates, as well as raise rates to help assure statewide access to dental care. We're especially interested in continuing to learn how OneCare will work in regards to third-party administrators. We continue to advocate for direct contracting with providers to get the best deal for Minnesotans and ensure that healthcare professionals, not insurance companies, are driving patient treatment. While it's not in the bill, we're in strong support of the governor's proposal to eliminate the sunset on the provider tax. Without that, many of the goals of this budget would be impossible. Thanks.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And Mr. Peterson.
Madam Chair, committee members, Rod Peterson with AMC. I'm just going to talk about the provider tax. If it's not broke, don't fix it. The provider tax works. Don't break it. This committee spent time last night discussing the importance of programming that is resourced by the Health Care Access Fund. A priority for counties is maintaining Healthcare Access Fund to maintain access to critical health care and prevention services. Extending the provider tax is paramount. We support principles of financial stability and the quality of the programs the Healthcare Access Fund has made possible. If the fund is unable to support these programs, counties will not be able to absorb the cost, and therefore millions of Minnesota's lose viable services. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Alita Borud, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Alita Borud, a physician and member of the Healthcare Committee of Land Stewardship Project, an organization supporting family farmers. I do that work because despite the current crises for farmers, affordability and access to health care remains the number one issue for our member farmers. I'm here to support Article 9, Section 13, Subdivision 1 regarding the OneCare buy-in. Specifically, people need access to comprehensive quality care, which would be offered with the 90% actuarial value plan with a benefit set similar to Minnesota Care. In the hospital, I cared for many farmers who presented with very advanced disease because they simply couldn't afford to access their care due to high deductibles, or they couldn't access care locally due to restrictive networks. These problems in the individual market would be much improved with a public insurance program, OneCare. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the room who wanted to talk about the health care sections of the bill? Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your time. Eric Dick with the Minnesota Medical Association. Wanted to briefly amplify something that you heard earlier from Ms. Krenke from the Hospital Association. We at the MMA have some question about the registration for the prescribing for controlled substances. This is a really quite substantial change in law, and should the committee be interested in considering that, we hope that you'll have a more thorough hearing because it is quite a departure. It's worth noting that prescribers, physicians, and other prescribers are licensed by the health board, so there is some oversight of prescribers. Those that prescribe controlled substances are also required to have a DEA license, and the accreditation process also serves as a bit of oversight. So we think that these are really important issues that probably deserve a full hearing.
Thank you very much for your testimony. The hot topic, health care. Anybody else in the room who wants to address that? Okay. Then we will move on to the sections that relate to the Department of Health, or at least that's how we've categorized them here on the agenda, public health issues. So we have Amanda Jansen. Okay, so Amanda Jansen and then Barti Wahi, and then we'll open it up. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Amanda Jansen with Clearway Minnesota, as well as the Minnesotans for a Smoke-Free Generation Coalition. We appreciate this opportunity to thank the governor and lieutenant governor for including funding for statewide quit smoking services in their budget proposal. As this committee has heard earlier this session, Clearway Minnesota was established as a life-limited organization, and we will sunset by 2022. The quit smoking program we have operated for 18 years, known as Quitplan Services, will end in just over a year. Clearway Minnesota is ready to pass the baton to the state to operate these services. Every state in the country provides quit smoking services. If the legislature does not take action this year, we will become the only state not providing them. We know that nearly 600,000 Minnesotans still smoke and nearly half want to quit. We are grateful to the governor for showing his commitment to the health and the state with this proposed funding. We support this proposal. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Welcome back.
Hi, I promised last time. okay. Again, my name is Barti Wahi, and I am the executive director of the Children's Defense Fund. I'm back here again because, as you can see, one of the things we appreciate about the governor's budget is that it centers the experiences of children and family to improve child outcomes. We are here to support the Community Solutions for Healthy Child Development Grant Program, which is part of the bill. By 2035, one in four children in the state of Minnesota will be a child of color, or American Indian child. They are our future leaders, but Minnesota faces some of the worst disparities tied to child well-being for children of color and American Indian children in the country. Oftentimes, these disparities exist because we, in part, have not been able to determine and understand how we best position our public policies in a way that leverage the assets and the strengths of communities. The Community Solutions Fund, Community Solutions Grant Program, is an innovative way to really create an investment strategy in communities themselves. It brings those who are most impacted by these disparities into the decision-making process, okay, so that we can address the unique and challenging needs that cultural communities face to improve child outcomes from health to education.
Okay, I'm sorry, we have to ask you to wrap it up.
We just ask you to support this bill and to watch for House File 1381, which we hope will be before you. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there someone else who wants to testify on the public health portions? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Brooke LaFleur. I'm a member of the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa, an aide at the Montessori American Indian Child Care Center, and a member of the Voices and Choices for Children Coalition. Voices and Choices is a coalition that focuses on improving outcomes for American Indian children and children of color ages 0 to 8. We focus on the implementation of policies and practices that meaningfully address these disparities that exist in Minnesota. In Article 12, we support the Community Solutions for Healthy Children Development Grant Program. Communities of color and American Indian communities have endured assimilation policies for centuries, ultimately leading to the disparity gaps we are seeing. Rarely are we included in these rooms. If nothing has improved without us besides growing disparity gaps, then is it not time to change something? Community Solutions Grant Program represents more than money. It also is recognition of communities of color, American Indian communities, and geographically dispersed communities that have valuable, invaluable knowledge and must be active and valued participants within the creation of solutions for themselves. Centering our solutions engages our communities. Supporting our communities is critical because these children will be future leaders of our state. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wants to speak to the public health issues in the bill? Please come on up if you do. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. I'm Reverend Dr. Jean Lee, and actually my issues apply to both the health and human services in general. You're going to be having some handouts. I won't get into the organizations I represent. It's in the handout. I'm a former Fortune 500 corporate auditor who switched to addressing the needs of the communities and people who are unserved and underserved using systems change to improve their lives and save lives. There are two areas that I wanted to cover, and this applies to both health and human services. One is that they need to retool how they're doing things, especially in response to the aging of America. And retooling means also redesigning their systems, their programs, services, and granting to better address the needs of individuals so that they could remain healthy in their homes and communities. And this includes
We need you to wrap it up, please.
Okay. Includes expanding their knowledge and ability to access opportunities. You see an amendment that we're proposing on the back. The governor and lieutenant governor have said that they support the need for community solutions and nonprofits willing to help.
We need to wrap it up because you're way over the minute now.
Okay, well, yeah. the two
can. It was 1 minute. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I ask that you also address the last item, which I haven't had a chance to cover and will be covered later.
Thank you for your testimony. So we have 4 minutes left in our hearing today. And is there anyone in the room who wants to testify generally on the bill as a whole? I'm not seeing anyone who wants to do that. Members, we are scheduled to continue tonight if members would like to do that, to have a discussion on the bill, and we certainly are open to doing that. We will be reconvening after the floor session in room 5. I would say call of the chair in room 5 to have discussion on what we've heard today. I do want to just thank everyone who testified. Again, we apologize for keeping you to 1 minute. Obviously, it is difficult to do. We appreciate that we did not give any of you a full hearing. But again, I want to emphasize this is not our only opportunity. And to let you know that, every member of this committee is, I know I can speak for them and say that they are open to hearing from you and your concerns. And we are a team, and we will be talking more about every one of the issues that was discussed today. Representative Franson, did you have a question?
No, I can wait.
Okay, so we will be reconvening members at after the floor session, call of the chair in room 5. So with that, and with deep appreciation for all of you and for your outstanding cooperation in giving us very brief testimony today, the committee is in recess. So we are back calling the HHS Finance Committee Division back to order. So we have before us House File 2184, which is the Governor's HHS budget bill. And we heard a lot of testimony this afternoon. We heard walkthroughs, a walkthrough of the bill, or at least not, I shouldn't say a walkthrough, but some some explanation about what was in the bill. And so this would be our opportunity, first of all, if members had questions. I think we do have people in the room who might be able to answer just, you know, basic questions about the bill. The other purpose of resuming tonight is to take any amendments that members care to offer and just to allow for some discussion if members want to do that. And then the intention is to lay over House File 2184 for possible inclusion in the HHS omnibus bill. So, Representative Grinhagen.
Yeah, and I know, Madam Chair, this is just being laid over, and we don't know what parts will be in the omnibus and not. But just a couple quick questions that maybe could have some clarification if anybody has input on it. You know, what's the rationale in the governor's bill to reduce long-term care by $200 million? It seems those are the people that, you know, the testimony, if I remember right, said it'll affect staff, the ability to pay staff. We're talking about the most vulnerable people, if not the most vulnerable, in the state of Minnesota. And I just find it, you know, I'm just wondering about the rationale for reducing that by $200 million.
Yeah, thank you for the question, Representative Grinhagen. Are you talking about the value-based reimbursement for nursing homes? Okay. I wonder, do we have anybody from DHS
who could discuss that?
Yeah.
We got a volunteer.
Mr. Greenman, welcome to the committee. I guess you drew the short straw.
Right.
Thank you. Did you hear the question?
I did, Madam.
All right.
Thank you. Madam Chair, and Representative Grinhagen, Dave Greenman with the Department of Human Services. I'm the budget director at the department. I believe the rationale behind this proposal is a couple things. One is in 2015, the legislature passed a significant reform in the way we pay nursing homes in the state, and it provided value-based reimbursement is what it's called. And it's meant, what it's meant to do is it's meant to incent quality among nursing facilities by basically by setting rates and requiring quality to reach a certain level before you get it bases the rates based on quality. One of the, you know, our experience with that system has been that rates have been going up pretty significantly in the nursing home industry since we passed it in 2015. They're going up around 7% a year. In fact, between fiscal year 16 and fiscal year 21, the value-based reimbursement system itself has contributed about $650 million to the cost of nursing facility care in the state. And so one of the things we were directed to do was to look at number one, look at the quality-based reimbursement system and see if it's actually working. And one of the things we found is virtually every nursing home in the state is well below the quality line. In other words, quality is not having an incentive, or it's not influencing. There's no incentive to improve quality with the value-based reimbursement the way it currently is. So the goal here is to adjust the quality-based reimbursement system so that it does actually incent quality. That does have an impact on some nursing homes. The goal of value-based reimbursement in the first place was to incent quality, and that's what this aims to do. This makes a number of other changes as well. One of the things this looks at is other operating costs that nursing facilities get paid for. Part of their reimbursement is things like laundry and nutrition and other non-direct care type of services. What this proposal does is it limits that to a national market-based index of nursing home costs, which is about a 3% increase per year. That had been increasing at 7% a year. So that scales, that doesn't reduce rates. What it does is it lowers the amount by which they increase every year. And so there's also a property rate reform as well that's meant to adjust the way we pay for property adjustments, property-based payment rates.
Mm-hmm. Representative Grinhagen.
Okay, well, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, thanks for that explanation at least. I just had one other question, Madam Chair.
I'm sorry.
I just had one other question.
Please, Representative.
And I know the rest of the bill, you know, I got other questions on other parts, but just
sure.
These two.
Please.
A testimony about the fee on medical providers who prescribe an opioid, that $125 plus a few other things. And the testimony we had from interested parties was that may, and I talked to him afterwards, that may really scare medical providers from prescribing at all. They'll just wash their hands of it, and then we have patients who really do need to use the opioids in a way responsibly to deal with their pain. And so that's a concern of mine. I have a brother-in-law who is in that situation, and his doctor just told him he's not going to even mess with it anymore, so he has to find a different doctor. And he's used opioids for nerve pain, which he has all over his body, for severe at times, for probably 4 to 5 years. And he's done it in a responsible way. But so my concern is that type of a fee and stuff is going to have a chilling effect for the people who actually need it. And the other part of that question is, was that fee part of the $20 million, or is that in addition to the $20 million? I got two different perspectives on that. One said it was part of the $20 million. The other was it's in addition to the $20 million opioid bill that we passed. And I sure hope it's not in addition to the opioid bill that we passed, because then it's just going to further drive up the cost, and besides having a chilling effect. I don't know if anybody's in the room that can just comment to that briefly, but that is a concern of mine.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Representative Gruenhagen. And, you know, just I'm glad you're asking these questions. That's what this meeting's for, and I just want to say I kind of share your concern about that one.
Okay.
Dr. Weiberg, can you speak to that?
I can. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Cody Weiberg. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy. That particular provision is one actually that came from the Board of Pharmacy. And just briefly tell you a little bit about the history.
And Mr. Weiberg, we can't hear you too well. I don't know what the deal is there.
Is this one better?
Yeah.
Okay, again, in case you didn't hear me at all, Dr. Cody Weiberg, I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy. And that particular provision in the governor's budget did come from the Board of Pharmacy. Just a little bit of history of this. If you've been here, you know that this is the third session where we have worked on opioid abuse and try to come up with some sort of funding mechanism. And I've provided technical assistance on just about every sort of proposal that's out there, House, Senate, Republican, Democrat. Late last session, both Representative Baker and Senator Rosen asked me to come up with some other idea in case the provisions that we're moving through did not make it. And so I actually developed this proposal. When I developed the proposal, I was looking for several things. One would be something that I thought would reliably produce revenues. It's been mentioned in testimony in House File 400 and Senate File 751. There is concern about lawsuits being involved with that legislation. 25 or 26 other states have a controlled substance registration system that's equivalent to the DEA registration system. So this is certainly something many other states have done. And so I think it's more legally defensible. It addresses another issue. It's not the primary reason I thought this was a good idea, but it addresses another issue that has cropped up. Including, I believe, Senator Benson had a question about this the last time 751 was heard in her committee, which is the House File 400 and Senate File 751 focus on manufacturers and on wholesalers, but no one else involved in the entire process. The Controlled Substance Registration System would, the way that it's in the governor's budget, would actually ask manufacturers and wholesalers to pay larger fees, quite significantly larger, not as large as some of the fees maybe in the other bills, but wholesalers and manufacturers would pay $75,000 fees. Prescribers would actually pay the least. They would pay $125 fees, which is akin to what other states charge prescribers that have these sorts of programs. The idea here, I was actually asked last year in Senator Rosen's committee. Senator Limmer had the last question, and he asked Senator Rosen, how did we get in the crisis that we are? And my answer was that really everyone involved in the process does have some sort of, has played some sort of role. Drug manufacturers certainly have inappropriately marketed drugs, we're involved right now with the Attorney General's office in a lawsuit against one of those manufacturers. Drug wholesalers, all three of the big drugs wholesalers have agreed to pay tens of millions of dollars in fines to the DEA on the basis of allegations that they did not report suspicious transactions to the DEA as they're required, allowing pill mills to operate. Pharmacies in my profession, a couple of the big chains were fined tens of millions of dollars based on the allegation that they were not doing enough to have their pharmacist make sure that prescriptions were medically valid. And prescribers have certainly overprescribed. And so this was something that would actually hit everyone in that chain. So that was another thing I was asked to look at. I also believe that this has other policy purposes beyond potentially collecting money. One of those would be to, I believe, if it's crafted the way that the bill's crafted, it might be easier for the Board of Pharmacy to remove a controlled substance registration from a prescriber who is running a pill mill. We actually just had a DEA raid on a physician 2 days ago, with the allegation being that prescriber was overprescribing. In addition to that, we would have obtained information from manufacturers on all controlled substances that I think would be make it easier for us to manage the prescription monitoring program. Although we regulate dispensing, no matter who does dispensing, that includes dispensing out of prescribers' offices, that's sending drugs home with patients, we regulate that. But unlike some other states, we don't register prescribers who actually dispense, so we have no idea where they are. They're supposed to be reporting to the PMP, but we have no way of verifying that. This would allow us to do that. So in a nutshell, that's what that provision is about.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Weiberg. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your testimony, Dr. Weiberg, on that. Is it part of the $20 million, then, of the opioid bill we passed, or is this in addition to the provisions in this bill? There's a number of them, but I'm just address the $125. Is that in addition to the $20 million, or is it part of the $20 million?
Dr. Weiberg, I don't know if you want to answer, or is this this is something that Representative Olson could answer, since he's the author of the opioid bill.
Yeah, sure, Madam Chair. So the governor in his proposal, I think Dr. Weiberg is speaking specifically to a part of the governor's proposal around opioids relating to controlled substance registration. There's also additional piece of the governor's proposal, financial proposal in this bill that also spends general fund revenue and has other manufacturer and distributor. So Dr. Weiberg is speaking just about the controlled substance registration part, which was not in House File 400, which passed off the floor on Monday. And the chair or others could answer. I'm imagining that bill, along with what we do in the HHS, will be considered in its totality of how we approach the crisis. And I'm imagining there will be, based on what the governor has put forward, what the House has now passed, what the Senate decides to do, that would be, I would imagine we'd have a holistic way that we're approaching opioid, you know, the opioid crisis with multiple funding, but it was not in House File 400.
So, Madam Chair?
Representative Green.
Yeah, so then basically right now, depending on what comes out in the end, obviously we know how that works, it would be additional right now, the way it's written.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And
Representative Holt.
I think the governor, so the part of what we pass in House File 400, and then the governor has other things, so they're all on the table.
Yeah.
It could be in addition to. We could decide not to do it. I think all of that is still open for discussion.
So Representative Grunhagen, be clear, Representative Grunhagen, so as you know, the governor's budget is the governor's proposal.
Right,
the House has the ability to put forward
right.
other things.
Yep.
Right. Representative Olson has her bill that passed off the floor. At the end of the day, we'll have to figure out how to coordinate it.
Right.
So it's
depending
kind of
on targets
it's a bit
stuff.
Of a moving question right
yeah,
now, I
no,
guess, is the answer.
Better. Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
All right.
All
okay,
right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. And let me just ask, members, it's almost 6 o'clock. I know that some members do need to go to other committees, so let me just ask, are there going to be amendments offered this evening? So nobody's offering amendments. Okay, so we can continue. Just and you know, just to be fair to members, often members have multiple obligations. I know there are other committees that members may need to get to. So are there other questions? And right, I appreciated that conversation. Are there, and there are. I saw that Mr. Pollack came into the room. Representative Grunhagen. Mr. Pollack is here. If you wanted to ask more about the nursing Yay. Home issue, he is here from DHS. Mr. Greenman from DHS is the budget director. But are we good with that one? Okay. Members, are there other questions or other? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Haley, you had your hand up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had two questions on, and maybe I could have heard it wrong this afternoon in the presentation, but if somebody could clarify, I thought I heard that the TANF fund has a reserve, and they were questioning could we use that to pay for the increase in MFIB instead of using the general fund.
Yes.
Could somebody clarify?
And Representative Haley, I mean, Mr. Greenman, if you can come up and address it, it's fine. I mean, unfortunately, Mr. Berg is not here, and he had talked about this previously in a hearing that we had. It did go by pretty fast, but come on up, Mr. Greenman, if you can address this. I know that a testifier kind of believes that there's money sitting there, and I had understood Mr. Berg's explanation to be that is not really the case. And Mr. Greenman, can you shed light on that? I'm so glad you asked the question, because I actually really want to understand this better, too.
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Haley, Dave Greenman with the Department of Human Services. The there is a lot of confusion around the TANF fund balance. Typically what happens is we show a certain there's an offset between what the state pays for the MFIT program that we need to pay in order to pay our share and to meet our MOE requirements, our maintenance of effort requirements, and what TANF picks up. And so there's a sort of a one-to-one relationship between what we pay for TANF and we pay for MFIP and what TANF pays for MFIP. And so we do have a balance in the TANF account. However, if we were to over time that and the forecast that balance goes down to zero. And so if we were to start spending that TANF balance, we would actually be spending we would increase the general fund obligation later on. And so it's not a balance that's sitting there waiting to be spent. It's actually projected to be spent over time. And if we start taking the money from there, we'll actually be spending down, leaving ourselves with a general fund hole later on. I don't know if that makes sense or is helpful.
Representative Haley?
Yep, Madam Chair, and over in this biennial forecast, when you say over time, are we talking about cycle?
Madam Chair, Representative Haley, by the end of fiscal year 23, we will have a balance, and I don't have the exact number now. It is somewhere around $50 million. By fiscal year 23, we'll have a balance of $3 million in it. And what the governor proposes to do is to spend that $3 million to offset the cost of the MFIP $100 increase. So there is still $3 million sitting at the end of fiscal year 23, at the end of the budget horizon. Normally it's at zero. There's $3 million now that we can spend, and we do actually spend that money for the $100 per month increase in MFIP grants.
Representative Haley, is that clear to you?
Probably as clear as it's going to get tonight, Madam Chair.
Yeah. I thought I'd get that kind of an answer because I'm feeling a little bit like that, too. So thank you. Thank you for that, Mr. Greenman. I mean, this is just one of those. It just kind of illustrates how complicated this budget is, and appreciate that. And we will return to that, I'm sure. I know I will, and, you know, we'll in maybe, you know, sometimes when we get the explanation two or three different times, this works for me. Sometimes if two or three different people explain it to me, I might get it at some point. So
I have an additional question. I don't know if you're rotating, but
sure. Hang on, Mr. Greenman. Did you want to say something more?
I was just going
to
say, Madam Chair and Representative Haley, we're happy to sit down with you and go through it in a little more detail if that would be helpful. To sort of, it's probably easier than to look at something, to look at the fund balance and have us explain it to you than to for me to try to explain it.
Thank you. Yeah, without the visual.
Right.
Okay, Representative Haley, go ahead.
And my other question was related to the DWRS and the 7% wage. That has been something I think that's been very bipartisan, and we've been talking about it, and it's been such an issue for those folks that take care of Minnesotans with disabilities. So I wondered if I could get an explanation on the governor's proposal for a 4.7, which isn't the full factor that we need to restore that cut.
Who would be Mr. Greenman? Do you want to tackle that one, or is there? I see Heidi Hamilton is here. Maybe she would be the person to discuss that. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Heidi
and
Hamilton.
Please pull the mic really close. We're having a little audio problem tonight.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Heidi Hamilton with the Department of Human Services. Representative, can you please repeat your question?
Representative Haley.
My understanding from the budget is the governor's proposal is a 4.7, what he's calling a competitive workforce factor. This is to replace the 7% unintentional, I think I can call it, cut to those folks that take care of people with disabilities, either in-home or facilities. And I'm wondering why he isn't supportive of a full 7% reimbursement, which now I guess would be over 8% to fully restore that cut.
Ms. Hamilton.
Madam Chair, Representative Haley, I just want to clarify that it wasn't a 7% cut that many providers saw. After model adjustment was designed, it was an additional increase to the rate beyond the disability waiver rate system framework, and that's what CMS denied. Most providers and most services actually did not see that 7% increase because most services were still banded to historic rates. And so it's actually about 25% of the services that received that rate increase. And so what the governor's proposal is to embed the competitive workforce factor into the framework so that there is a way for us to continue to have that ongoing into the future and for it not to be an after-model adjustment that is not part of the framework based on research and information that we can look at and make sure that that goes for a specific purpose.
Representative Haley, I wonder if maybe Representative Schultz, could you try to help a little? Because, you know, Representative Schultz is chairing the long-term care division, and she's been doing quite a bit of work with us, so maybe she could take a crack at, I don't know, obviously this isn't her proposal, but she
no.
could
so
talk
we're
about.
Working with the providers really closely, I think they now understand the 7% after outside of the framework adjustment. Ms. Hamilton is right on that, of course. They got an 8.5% increase, an inflationary increase, and CMS said, well, you can't both do two inflationary increases. And so they disallowed the 7.5%, but then they got an 8.5% increase. And so what we're doing is we're trying to get wages to go up that are competitive. So this competitive workforce factor will look at to make sure that wages are competitive with other occupations that are similar that aren't controlled by the government, because we control the reimbursement rates and that disrupts the labor market. So we are going to try to do a really good job of looking at wages in competitive occupations with wages in this occupation, and over time make sure our rate increases for the services, that some of those rate increases are going to wage increases to keep up with wage inflation. And so we, I think, have everybody on board with this competitive workforce factor and automatic inflationary increases every two years looking at BLS labor data. So I think everyone now is supportive of the legislation that's been moving forward that will come to this committee. And so we'll get another hearing on that bill, and you can learn more about it and offer amendments and look at it. And we'll have testimony from the providers and look at that bill.
And Representative Haley, is that helpful?
Yeah. Yes, I
another really
it is. And in the interest of time tonight and the fact that we will get to hear it in more detail, but I appreciate that background of the work that the committee is doing. Thank you for your explanation.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Haley. I mean, that's a really good question, and it's this has been a very, very confusing issue, not only because it's confusing in itself, but it's also been changing. And so, you know, Representative Grunhagen, it is somewhat of a moving target, but you know, I know that number 7% was kind of the number on the bumper sticker, but it's because there's been so much change in this area, including in changes that came from the federal government about how we do the rates, how we calculate the rates, not only having to do with their disallowing the stacking, but just making us have a statewide system and how we do that system and how long it's taken to get it into place. And remember the banding we were holding the providers harmless, at least many of them for most things, and then the banding's coming off. And, you know, the bottom line, I think, is that, and I don't exactly know if the governor's proposal is, it's probably a little different than the one that Representative Schultz is working on. It's a work in progress, and the bottom line seems to be that we have to make sure that people earn wages that allow them to want to work in this field and allow the providers to provide the service without breaking the bank. And it's a really delicate thing to do, because this is an area where this spending is huge. And I think we all know that as our population is aging and we're dealing with more chronic diseases, all of us are always talking about the cost of health care and how we're going to control costs. And we all want to make sure that people with disabilities get appropriate services and that the providers are able to stay in business and so on. But there is a difficult balance going on here with being able to do that and have it be sustainable as our population grows and we have more people there. So I think that's kind of the overall, everybody's nodding, Representative Schultz is nodding, that's kind of where we're all working. And we, you know, happy to work with anyone else who wants to get deep in the weeds, because the weeds are deep. Other questions, members? Okay, I'm not seeing any other questions. We have no amendments, so I think that we could, if there's no other business tonight before the committee, I really appreciate everyone being here today. Mr. McClelland, is there anything we need to let people know? Yeah, so members, I just want to warn you that next week we will likely be doing evening meetings. We will be probably Friday. So, you know, just, you know, be prepared. Hope you get a lot of rest this weekend, because we're all going to, it's going to get worse from here. So with that, it'll get worse before it gets better, put it that way. Yes. Thank you. We are adjourned.